Carlos Lozada is a Pulitzer Prize-winning opinion columnist at the New York Times. In his new book, The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians, he explores how people in power reveal themselves through their books and writings, and in so doing, illuminates the personal, political, and cultural conflicts driving Washington and the nation as a whole. As a longtime book critic and columnist in Washington, Lozada dissects all manner of texts, commission reports, political reporting, Supreme Court decisions, and congressional inquiries to understand the controversies animating life in the Capitol. He also reads copious books by politicians and top officials, tell-all accounts by administration insiders, campaign biographies by candidates longing for high office, and revisionist memoirs by those leaving those offices behind. It is a fascinating collection. The book is The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians, and we welcome Carlos Lozada to the roundtable this morning. Carlos, thank you very much for being with us. A great honor to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
What was lacking in the world that made you think that you wanted to take on this project and write The Washington Book?
I've been a book critic and a columnist focusing on books for about a decade now, writing about Washington books. And whenever people learn that that's how I make a living, they always give me this weird response. They say, "Thank you for reading all that so that we don't have to." as if I'm to be commended for discharging some painful public service on everyone's behalf. The assumption is that all these Washington books, all the political memoirs and the Washington reports and the biographies and campaign books, are all sort of boring or, you know, ghostwritten propaganda. But I'm actually a real believer in Washington books. I find them enormously useful and revealing. And that's because even when politicians present themselves in the most benign and favorable light, as they do in these books, when they try to sanitize their records and their experiences, they always end up revealing themselves with their own words. They show us their fears, their insecurities. They show us not just their beliefs, but something about their character.
So what is it about the Washington Book? I guess let's go for a definition of that. Someone who has served in a political or in surrounding in sort of the setup of a political world, that they would have had a part in that.
That's certainly part of it. I think of Washington books as being in a few buckets. One is precisely that, the political memoir by the outgoing official, the presidential memoirs, the campaign books that candidates write. Also, it's the journalists who write about these figures and about these forces in our politics. But also, I think of these days especially, you know, special counsel investigations, congressional committee reports, Supreme Court opinions, all that kind of ritual documentation of Washington. I include all of that in how I see Washington books. And so in my book, I write about all of those things, from the presidential memoir to the latest indictment of a sitting politician.
The big question is, for a book lover, to know if it's worth reading and buying, in the sense of, have we heard everything this person has to say already? In other words, if they're part of a scandal or they're part of a momentous news event, and perhaps they've already testified, are we learning anything new? And you believe we do?
I think we do, and here's why. Certainly, when these books come out, reporters, political reporters, just pour all over them and, you know, write the articles where they give you the, you know, here are the five takeaways on so-and-so's book. But those aren't the things that I read for when I read these books. It's these books. It's the little things. It's the recurring line that they use a little too often. It's a throwaway comment they made to an aide. It's even the acknowledgement section of a book that tells you something about them. I'll give you one of my favorite examples. It's in a book by Reggie Love, who was Barack Obama's personal aide when Obama was running for president and then later early in his presidency. And there's a moment during the 2008 campaign when Reggie Love forgot to bring Obama's briefcase on the plane when they were headed to a debate, which is a big no-no for the personal aide, for the body man. He thought Obama would fire him, and Obama, Senator Obama then, was annoyed but forgave him. And he mentioned to Reggie Love one of the reasons that he was so annoyed about the missing bag. He wanted to be seen carrying something off the plane. It projected a kind of image that he wanted to show. And as he told Reggie Love, JFK carried his own bags, right? And that little line, JFK carried his own bag, is the one thing I remember most from Reggie Love's memoir about working for Obama, because it shows you how carefully Obama thought about the public image that he was projecting and he was cultivating, and how he even drew on our most mythologized former president to think about how he wanted to show himself to the world. That to me was very revealing, and I never would have learned it if I hadn't read Reggie Love's memoir.
Do we know what to believe and what not to believe? I mean, using that example, we assume that what Reggie Love is telling us is accurate.
Right. And when you read these books, you have to be a very skeptical and careful consumer. And I try to be. It's not always, though, you know, is this true or is this a lie? It's often more like, what is emphasized here? What is included and what is omitted? I'll give you my favorite example about that. I recently read and wrote about in this book, Mike Pence's memoir, So Help Me God, where
right.
he wrote a lot about the events of January 6th. And, you know, taking something of a victory lap for how he discharged his duties that day. But in the book, he quotes Donald Trump's video statement from the afternoon of January 6th, when Trump finally told the rioters to leave the Capitol. And he quotes him extensively. And the way he quotes him is he says, you know, here's what Trump said. He said, you know, I know your pain. I know you're hurt, dot, dot, dot. There's an ellipsis there. But you have to go home now. We have to have peace. And when I read it, I wondered, like, what did Pence skip over when he's quoting Trump's statement from that day? So I went to the video, and I saw that in the middle of that statement, just the part that Pence skipped with that ellipsis, Trump had said, this was a landslide election that we won. It was stolen from us. Everyone knows it. Only then did he go on to say, but you have to go home now. We have to have peace. So even on that day when Pence had to escape from the Capitol, when Donald Trump didn't help him, when he seemed to have his life in danger to some extent, Pence was still covering for his boss, covering for the lies about the election. And so I found that omission extremely illuminating to me, far more than if I caught Pence saying something that wasn't true elsewhere in the book.
You write about that, saying you shouldn't get the glory for pulling democracy back from the brink if you helped carry it there in the first place.
Right. One thing I found in Pence's book is that, you know, he had made up his own mind about the results of the 2020 election long before January 6th, and yet never either expressed it directly to the president or to the public. If you were an enabler throughout, it seemed a bit much to me to then, you know, beat your chest about how you sort of save things at the end.
And with Pence, it's fascinating, too, because we learned more since the book has come out, and he's been more open and more critical, certainly, of Donald
yes.
Trump than he was in his actual book, which is fascinating in and of itself.
You know, when you think of these books, there's a sort of permanence to them, right? These are politicians, you know, laying down in hardcovers their perspectives, their recollections, their positions for history. And yet, I think now that Pence has, at least for the moment, given up on his own presidential ambitions, he feels more empowered to be critical of the former president, and perhaps most famously, to be one of the Republicans who has said he's not endorsing him for the presidency. The only moment they gave me a little clue to that is in the acknowledgement section of So Help Me God, of his memoir, where he thanked just about everyone except his former boss in the White House, Donald Trump. He did not mention him.
You touched on this earlier, but I am interested because not only is it the political memoir, but you are also looking at government reports of whether that be the Mueller report, the 2019 House Intelligence Committee report on Ukraine and Hunter Biden, and the 2022 House Select Committee report on his role in January 6th. When you tackle those together, you learn more, right?
Oh, absolutely. I knew that when the January 6th committee report was published that I was going to read it and write about it. But to me, it seemed a lot more useful to put that report in conversation with some of these others. So I wrote about, as you say, the Mueller report, the Ukraine report, and the January 6th report together. And what I realized is that in many ways, the latter two reports, Ukraine and January 6th, were, in a sense, learning the lessons of the Mueller report. They were trying to avoid what they may have perceived as the shortcomings of the Mueller report. I thought the Mueller report was true to its author. You know, he was very restrained in what he, Robert Mueller, in what he felt he could do and how far he could go. But he left a trail of breadcrumbs, sort of reminding future investigators and perhaps future members of Congress that you needed to look and evaluate Donald Trump's actions collectively. You know, how put together what perspective are they giving you? Whereas the Mueller report itself, you know, bent over backwards to give Trump the benefit of the doubt in sort of parsing each specific thing that he could that he did, and you know, maybe he wasn't doing this for self-serving or illegal reasons. Maybe there's a governance question here. You know, all the reticence that the Mueller report displayed, especially in feeling that it couldn't you know, charge the president with any crime because he was a sitting president. You know, all that reticence is gone once you see the future investigations into Donald Trump. So there's a cumulative story here that you don't get by reading just individual reports or even individual books. All these stories build on each other.
Carlos Lozada is our guest. The name of the book is The Washington Book. I'm curious as to what we do read and why things become popular. There are many times when a book like Mike Pence's book or say somebody within the administration, the current administration or the Trump administration writes a book and it'll wind up on the New York Times bestseller list for a week or two. And then it goes through its news cycle of a week or two. And then it falls by the wayside and is forgotten except for people like you who write about it. I want to bring up two exceptions, at least in my thinking of it. And like, what is it about a Liz Cheney Oath and Honor book that strikes a chord?
There's several factors there. You know, one is that Cheney became something of a Washington rock star through her work on the January 6th committee report. And there were people both on the right and on the left who became big fans of her. She had what you might call in other fields crossover appeal, even as she was losing power in her own party. So I think she had a big stage ahead of time. I think people were eager to learn the story that she had to tell. And also, the book came out at a time when Cheney was still sort of teasing the notion of, oh, you know, I might get in the mix of the presidential campaign, you know, let's see. And so all these factors created a sort of anticipation and ongoing interest in Liz Cheney. You know, she took a difficult stance. She suffered for it in her party. And that created, I think, more interest in that kind of book than, say, a book by Adam Schiff. Right, which I also read and reviewed his memoir. I thought it was interesting. There was plenty there, but even as he became such a public figure through his work in the Trump impeachment over Ukraine, you know, it didn't have that same kind of wide impact in terms of the appeal of his book because he was still perceived as a figure for only one side of the political spectrum.
Speaking of one side of the political spectrum, the other aspect that I find interesting when you look at the bestseller list is the journalist du jour of, say, a Fareed Zakaria or a Jesse Watters, who make the bestseller list for a few weeks. These are media people who are writing about what is happening in our world. And it seems to me, given your earlier definition, that these are considered Washington books.
Yes, I would think of them as Washington books. A book doesn't have to emanate from Washington to have resonance in Washington. Someone like Jesse Watters has a massive platform via Fox News, and you know, Fareed Zakaria is a columnist for The Washington Post and has a weekly show on CNN. These are very different kinds of writers and kinds of books. Fareed Zakaria specializes in some of these sort of, you know, big think books. I think his latest one is called The Age of Revolutions. And, you know, that has appeal to general interest readers, perhaps to corporate readers, whereas the Watters book is the kind, and you know, the books that he writes and that other sort of TV media personalities write have appeal, you know, for more partisan audiences. But they have intense partisan audience appeal, and that results in their commercial success. I should say, I have no insight into the secret sauce that makes up the New York Times bestseller list. It's a tightly guarded formula. And I work at the Times, but I have no idea how it comes together. So I'm not speaking specifically about, I would love to know, by the way, because then I might try to crack it myself. But I just think that there's a built-in sort of home field advantage for writers who also have, you know, well-regarded or at least well-viewed television shows.
And do we still learn in perhaps another way, but do we still learn nuggets, still learn things as we do with a political memoir or a larger book on a particular page of our history?
I think so, except the way that I think about that is that I try to read a lot of books that deal with the same moment in time and that present different vantage points on that moment in time and that moment in history. And that's how, you know, when you look at the chapters in the Washington book, several of them deal with not just a single book, but multiple books at once. The 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. You know, there were many books that came out sort of looking back on that full period. And I could have reviewed, you know, one of those, but I felt that wouldn't be enough. I didn't want a single person's perspective. So what I did, I spent a few months reading about 20 books that looked at different aspects of 9/11, you know, the road to 9/11, how we got there, the events of that day, the wars that followed, you know, all these different aspects of 9/11. And then I sort of distilled all that into a single essay about what it meant. And to me, the best way to try to understand a particular moment in history, as you say, is to bring together a multiplicity of perspectives. When you look at the Trump presidency, you know, a lot of the early books were sort of written from the point of view of the Trump advisor, Steve Bannon, right? The sort of, you know, nationalistic right-wing voice. You look at a lot of the latter books towards the end of the Trump presidency, and a lot of them seem to have the influence of someone like General Mark Milley as a source, right?
Right.
A very different point of view on the Trump presidency. And just kind of recognizing that those are the different kinds of stories that are being told is important for any consumer of books, but also useful to see together. You know, there is truth in the Steve Bannon perspective of what happened in the Trump White House, and truth in the Milley perspective of how the administration unfolded.
So my final question for you is just out of curiosity, but you take a book like Sean Spicer's memoir, and written while Trump was still in office, there's nothing in there that is especially damning to the former president. My question for you is, books like that, they don't age well, right? Or do they?
You know, there are some political memoirs that I think probably do age well. One of my favorite political memoirs is by Barton Swaim, who was a speechwriter to Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina. Just a really nice book about the challenges of you know, working for a politician you don't quite respect and channeling a voice you don't quite admire, which is a reality of a lot of politics. But I think in general, you're probably right that books that are written when the author is still sort of in the middle of it and is still, you know, it still feels like he owes or she owes a lot to particular voices, and therefore maybe too deferential. It's not that they don't age well as much as they're not particularly useful. I find that, you know, from presidents to cabinet members to staffers on down, the most revealing books about politics are usually written long after the person in question has left office and they have some perspective and perhaps less skin in the game about the story that they're telling.
The name of the book is The Washington Book. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Carlos Lozada, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Washington Book. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.